the Yankees and the Braves' chance of victory, we simply make an accounting of the possible five-game sequences for the remainder of the series. First, the Yankees would have been victorious if they had won four of the five possible remaining games. That could have happened in one of five ways. B, YYYY. YBYYY. YYBYY. YYYBY. Or YYYYB. Alternatively, the Yankees would have triumphed if they had won all five of the remaining games, which could have happened in only one way. YYYYY. Now, for the Braves, they would have become champions if the Yankees had won only three games, which could have happened in 10 ways. BBYYY, BYBYY, and so on. Or if the Yankees had won only two games, which again could have happened in 10 ways. Or if the Yankees had won only one game, which could have happened in 5 ways. Or if they had won none, which could have happened in only one way. Adding these possible outcomes together, we find that the chance of a Yankees victory was 6 in 32, or about 19%, versus 26 in 32, or about 81% for the Braves. According to Pascal and Fermat, if the series had abruptly been terminated, that's how they should have split the bonus pot. And those are the odds that should have been set if a bet was to be made after the first two games. For the record, the Yankees did come back to win the next four games, and they were crowned champion. The same reasoning could also be applied to the start of the series, that is, before any game has been played. If the two teams have equal chances of winning each game, you will find, of course, that they have an equal chance of winning the series. But similar reasoning works if they don't have an equal chance, except that the simple accounting I just employed would have to be altered slightly. Each outcome would have to be weighed by a factor describing its relative probability. If you do that and analyze the situation at the start of the series, you will discover that in a 7-game series, there is a sizable chance that the inferior team will be crowned champion. For instance, if one team is good enough to warrant beating another in 55% of its games, the weaker team will nevertheless win a 7-game series about 4 times out of 10. And if the superior team could be expected to beat its opponent on average 2 out of each 3 times they meet, the inferior team will still win a 7-game series about 1 every 5 matchups. There is really no way for sports leagues to change this. In the lopsided 2 out of 3 probability case, for example, you'd have to play a series consisting of, at minimum, the best of 23 games to determine the winner with what is called statistical significance, meaning the weaker team would be crowned champion 5% or less of the time. And in the case of one team's having only a 55 to 45 edge, the shortest statistical significant World Series would be the best of 269 games. A tedious endeavor indeed. So sports playoff series can be fun and exciting, but being crowned world champion is not a very reliable indication that a team is actually the best one. As I said, the same reasoning applies to more than games, gambling, and sports. For example, it shows that if two companies compete head-to-head, or two employees within a company compete, though there may be a winner and a loser each quarter or each year, to get a reliable answer regarding which company or which employee is superior by simply tallying who beats whom, you'd have to make the comparison over decades or centuries. If, for instance, employee A is truly superior and would in the long run win a performance comparison with employee B on 60 out of 100 occasions, in a simple best-of-5 series of comparisons, the weaker employee will still win almost 1/3 of the time. It is dangerous to judge ability by short-term results. The counting in all these problems has been simple enough to carry out without much effort. But when the numbers are higher, the counting becomes difficult. Consider, for example, this problem. You are arranging a wedding reception for 100 guests, and each table seats 10. You can't sit your cousin Rod with your friend Amy because 8 years ago they had an affair and she dumped him. On the other hand, both Amy and Letitia want to sit next to your buff cousin Bobby, and your Aunt Ruth had better be at a table out of earshot, or the dueling flirtations will be gossip fodder for holiday dinners for the next 5 years. You carefully consider the possibilities. Take just the first table. How many ways are there to choose 10 people from a group of 100? That's the same question as, in how many ways can you apportion 10 investments among 100 mutual funds, or 10 germanium atoms among 100 locations in a silicone crystal? It's the type of problem that comes up repeatedly in the theory of randomness. And not only in the problem of points, but with larger numbers it is tedious or impossible to count the possibilities by listing them explicitly. That was Pascal's real accomplishment, a generally applicable and systematic approach to counting that allows you to calculate the answer from a formula or read it off a chart. It is based on a curious arrangement of numbers in the shape of a triangle. The computational method at the heart of Pascal's work was actually discovered by a Chinese mathematician named Jai Jian around 1050, published by another Chinese mathematician, Zhu Shiji, in 1303, discussed in a work by Cardano in 1570, and plugged into the greater whole of probability theory by Pascal, who ended up getting most of the credit. But the prior work didn't bother Pascal. "Let no one say I have said nothing new," Pascal argued in his autobiography. "The arrangement of the subject is new. When we play tennis, we both play with the same ball, but one of us places it better." The graphic invention employed by Pascal is thus called Pascal's triangle. His triangle is useful any time you need to know the number of ways in which you can choose some number of objects from a collection that has an equal or greater number. Here is how it works in the case of the wedding guests. To find the number of distinct seatings of 10 you can form from a group of 100 guests, you would start by looking down the numbers to the left of the triangle until you found the row labeled 100. The first number in row 100 tells you the number of ways you can choose 0 guests from a group of 100. There is just one way, of course. You simply don't choose anyone. That is true no matter how many total guests you are choosing from, which is why the first number in every row is 1. The second number in row 100 tells you the number of ways you can choose one guest from a group of 100. There are 100 ways to do that. You can choose just guest number 1 or just guest number 2 and so on. That reasoning applies to every row, and so the second number in each row is simply the number of that row. The third number in each row represents the number of distinct groups of 2 you can form, and so on. The number we seek, the number of distinct arrangements of 10 you can form, is therefore the 11th number in the row, which is a number far too large to put on this page. In fact, when some wedding guest inevitably complains about the seating arrangements, you might point out how long it would have taken you to consider every possibility. Assuming you spent 1 second considering each one, it would come to roughly 10 billion years. The unhappy guest will assume, of course, that you're being histrionic. In order for us to use Pascal's triangle, let's say for now that your guest list consists of just 10 guests. The numbers in that row represent the number of distinct tables of 0, 1, 2, and so on, that can be formed from a collection of 10 people. You may recognize these numbers from the 6th grade quiz example. The number of ways in which a student can get a given number of problems wrong on a 10-question true or false test is the same as the number of ways in which you can choose guests from a group of 10. That is one of the reasons for the power of Pascal's triangle. The same mathematics can be applied to many different situations. For the Yankees-Braves World Series example, in which we tediously counted all the possibilities for the remaining 5 games, we can now read the number of ways in which the Yankees can win. 0, 1, two, three, four, or five games directly from row number five at the triangle, which is 1, 5, 10, 10, 5, 1. We can see at a glance that the Yankees' chance of winning two games, 10 ways, was twice as high as their chance of winning one game, 5 ways. Once you learn the method, applications of Pascal's triangle crop up everywhere. A friend of mine once worked for a startup computer games company. She would often relate how, although the marketing director conceded that small focus groups were suited for qualitative conclusions only, she nevertheless sometimes reported an overwhelming 4-2 or 5-1 agreement among the members of the group, as if it were meaningful. But suppose you hold a focus group in which 6 people will examine and comment on a new product you are developing. Suppose that in actuality the product appeals to half the population. How accurately will this preference be reflected in your focus group? Now, the relevant line of the triangle is the one labeled 6, representing the number of possible subgroups of 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 whose members might like or dislike your product. And you get this: 1, 6, 15, 20, 15, 6, 1. From these numbers, we see that there are 20 ways in which the group members could split 50-50, accurately reflecting the views of the populace at large. But there are also 1 plus 6 plus 15 plus 15 plus 6 plus 1 equals 44 ways in which you might find an unrepresentative consensus, either for or against. So if you are not careful, the chances of being misled are 44 out of 64, or about 2/3. This example does not prove that if agreement is achieved, it is random, but neither should you assume that it is significant. Pascal and Fermat's analysis proved to be a big first step in a coherent mathematical theory of randomness. The final letter of their famous exchange is dated October 27, 1654. A few weeks later, Pascal sat in a trance for 2 hours. Some call that trance a mystical experience. Others lament that he had finally blasted off from planet sanity. However you describe it, Pascal emerged from the event a transformed man. It was a transformation that would lead him to make one more fundamental contribution to the concept of randomness. In 1662, a few days after Pascal died, a servant noticed a curious bulge in one of Pascal's jackets. The servant pulled open the lining to find hidden within it folded sheets of parchment and paper. Pascal had apparently carried them with him every day for the last 8 years of his life. Scribbled on the sheets in his handwriting was a series of isolated words and phrases dated November 23, 1654. The writings were an emotional account of the trance, in which he described how God had come to him and in the space of 2 hours delivered him from his corrupt ways. Following that revelation, Pascal had dropped most of his friends, calling them horrible attachments. He sold his carriage, his horses, his furniture, his library, everything except his Bible. He gave his money to the poor, leaving himself with so little that he often had to beg or borrow to obtain food. He wore an iron belt with points on the inside so that he was in constant discomfort and pushed the belt spikes into his flesh whenever he found himself in danger of feeling happy. He denounced his studies of mathematics and science. Of his childhood fascination with geometry, he wrote, "I can scarcely remember that there is such a thing as geometry. I recognize geometry to be so useless, it is quite possible I shall never think of it again." Yet Pascal remained productive. In the years that followed the trance, he recorded his thoughts about God, religion, and life. Those thoughts were later published in a book titled Pensée, a work that is still in print today. And although Pascal had denounced mathematics, amid his vision of the futility of worldly life as a mathematical exposition, in which he trained his weapon of mathematical probability squarely on a question of theology, and created a contribution just as important as his earlier work on the problem of points. The mathematics in Poncet is contained in two manuscript pages covered on both sides by writing going in every direction and full of erasures and corrections. In those pages, Pascal detailed an analysis of the pros and cons of one's duty to God as if he were calculating mathematically the wisdom of a wager. His great innovation was his method of balancing those pros and cons, a concept that is today called mathematical expectation. Pascal's argument went like this. Suppose you concede that you don't know whether or not God exists, and therefore assign a 50% chance to either proposition. How should you weigh those odds when deciding whether to lead a pious life? If you act piously and God exists, Pascal argued, your gain, eternal happiness, is infinite. If, on the other hand, God does not exist, your loss or negative return is small, the sacrifices of piety. To weigh these possible gains and losses, Pascal proposed, you multiply the probability of each possible outcome by its payoff and then add them all up, forming a kind of average or expected payoff. In other words, the mathematical expectation of your return on piety is one-half infinity, your gain if God exists, minus one-half a small number, your loss if he does not exist. Pascal knew enough about infinity to know that the answer to this calculation is infinite, and thus the expected return on piety is infinitely positive. Every reasonable person, Pascal concluded, should therefore follow the laws of God. Today, this argument is known as Pascal's wager. Expectation is an important concept not just in gambling, but in all decision-making. In fact, Pascal's wager is often considered the founding of the mathematical discipline of game theory, the quantitative study of optimal decision strategies in games. I must admit I find such thinking addictive, and so I sometimes carry it a bit too far. How much does that parking meter cost? I ask my son. The sign says 25 cents. Yes, but one time in every 20 or so visits I come back late and find a ticket, which runs $40. So the 25-cent cost of the meter is really just a cruel lure, I explain, because my real cost is $2.25. The extra $2 comes from my 1 in 20 chance of getting a ticket multiplied by its $40 cost. How about our driveway? I ask my other son. Is it a toll road? Well, we've lived at the house for about 5 years, or roughly 2,400 times of backing down the driveway, and 3 times I've clipped my mirror on the protruding fence post at $400 a shot. You may as well put a toll box out there and toss in 50 cents each time you back up, he tells me. He understands expectation. He also recommends that I refrain from driving them to school before I've had my morning coffee. Looking at the world through the lens of mathematical expectation, one often comes upon surprising results. For example, a recent sweepstakes sent through the mail offered a grand prize of $5 million. All you had to do to win was mail in your entry. There was no limit on how many times you could enter, but each entry had to be mailed in separately. The sponsors were apparently expecting about 200 million entries, because the fine print said that the chances of winning were 1 in 200 million. Does it pay to enter this kind of free sweepstakes offer? Multiplying the probability of winning times the payoff, we find that each entry is worth 1/40th of a dollar, or 2.5 cents, far less than the cost of mailing it in. In fact, the big winner in this contest was the post office, which, if the projections were correct, made nearly $80 million in postage revenue on all the submissions. Here's another crazy game. Suppose the state of California made its citizens the following offer. Of all those who pay the dollar or two to enter, most will receive nothing. One person will receive a fortune, and one person will be put to death in a violent manner. Would anyone enroll in that game? People do, and with enthusiasm. It is called the state lottery. And although the state does